On this episode of China Unscripted, communist tactics of ideological subversion, the war against memory, and why Mao Zedong was the best communist. Welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
And I'm Matt Ganesta.
And Shelley won't be with us today, sadly. But that's okay, because we have a fantastic guest joining us today. His name is Joshua Phillip. He is an award-winning senior investigative reporter at the Epoch Times. He has advised military and academic communities on the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare. He's here to talk to us today about communism and the subversion tactics used by China. Hi, Josh. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about communism. Like a lot of isms, it's hard to nail down a definition of it. And in the case of communism, I always hear that, oh, you know, that's not real communism. China isn't a real communist country. So for the purposes of this podcast, what are you defining as communism?
I would define communism as what I would say more its original form. A lot of people, how should I say, the history of communism is very complex. And a lot of people don't, unfortunately, know what that history is. Mm-hmm. When they think of it, they usually only think of its surface talking points. So things like they think it's like just an economic system. They think it's about sharing. They think it's about destroying capitalism or getting rid of the capitalist systems of the West. Some of them don't have any idea how communism relates to socialism. A lot of them don't understand how the various forms of communism interrelate. They think Marxism and, you know, Trotskyism and all the, you know,
or Maoism.
They think, you know, they think it's totally different from the next. So if you criticize one form, they say, oh, that wasn't communism. That was, you know, Leninism. Something like this.
Soviet Union's problem wasn't communism. It was Leninism.
Stalinism. Yeah, there you go. And so part of my work for the last, 11 years now, has been investigating the Chinese Communist Party's use of subversion in the United States. This has included on-the-ground investigations in New York into front organizations, even triads, tongs, these kinds of things. And through the process of investigating these things, I've, of course, had to go and learn what the heck are they doing, what is the history of what they're doing, how does it relate to, say, Soviet systems, how is the Chinese model different from the Soviet model, so on and so on, going deeper into their ideologies. And so basically when we get into the origins of communism, some people point to, let's say, the Paris Commune, right? What was it, 86? I can't remember the year.
1878 or something like that.
Yeah, 1870, something like that. We can look, right?
1871.
Yeah. So a lot of people point to that as the first real communist system. Some people, of course, argue that wasn't real communism.
Naturally.
But of course, if you get into the details of it, it was the Jacobins and, you know, different factions who kind of joined together to do it. It was a lot of the same groups that took part in the French Revolution. But by that time, the main organizers had already joined ranks with Marx. They'd already joined, you know, his big, you know, international talks and these things. What Marx did was brought together all the different socialist and communist movements. We can trace communism itself, the word, at the first mention we know of, at least, to the Cercle Social, which was one of the main groups that launched the French Revolution.
So you think it goes back to the days of the French Revolution?
Very much so.
Is before Marx, if people don't know.
Yeah, very, very much so. So why don't we start with this? So Leon Trotsky, in his autobiography, writes about the origins of communism. He says it goes back to, it sounds funny, but he says it goes back to, you know, the League of the Just, League of Outlaws, which had merged in with Marx's, you know, organizations to form kind of the United Communist.
So, sorry,
movement.
Who are those groups?
Right, so let me start from the beginning.
Okay. The League of the Just sounds kind of like a knockoff DC movie.
Yeah, I know.
The League of the Just, starring Super Guy.
So Leon Trotsky says it goes back to that. Mm-hmm. Before that was, the Cercle Social, and before that was the Carbonari Society, which he says came from the Illuminism, the Illuminati kind of whole movement that took place during the French Revolution.
Oh my gosh, the Illuminati is behind communism?
It was part of it, As I would rather not have that be the case, it is unfortunately.
So just for clarity, because Illuminati is like associated with conspiracy theories, but there was historically a group that was called the Illuminati or the Illuminism.
There were many of them. Which is, I think, where people get confused.
Illuminatis?
There were many different groups.
Is Illuminati singular, or is it one Illuminati, like Illuminato?
I have no idea.
Like, you know, spaghetti is like singular, or spaghetto.
Or octopi.
Right. Octopi, Illuminati. So anyway, there's a lot of Illuminati. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the two main ones. So the main one that we can point to that, without a doubt, had a huge influence, if not direct involvement with the French Revolution, was the Illuminati of Bavaria, and that was under Adam Weishaupt. He did try to launch a revolution. The individual carrying the orders to carry out the revolution was struck by lightning, and they allegedly found the notes on his body, and the government launched its investigation. He was arrested. His cronies were arrested.
Yeah, Zeus hates communism.
Other factions involved, people say the Carbonari were part of it. The Carbonari, it was a charcoal burner kind of association that had brought in some kind of weird occult type stuff. Their history is very weird.
So you're saying communism ties back to the Illuminati and the occult?
Basically.
Okay. Okay. So we're back now in like the 1790s, late 1780s.
Like 1750s, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because the French Revolution started in 1789.
Correct.
But these groups had already been like working since the 1750s.
Yeah. Well, the important thing to know is that when it came to the French Revolution and kind of the birth of communism, communism doesn't have a single origin from what I've researched. There were many, many groups and many, many different kind of ideologies that merged into it.
Many origins blended together, like the Starbucks Pike Place roast.
Yeah, funny enough. The old capitalist.
Okay, that's an analogy.
So the Illuminati of Bavaria, so because it was investigated, because the individuals involved were arrested, you can still read their documents, actually. Their stuff's all public. Hmm. Adam Weishaupt had, his system was actually extremely, extremely close to Marx. If you read what he taught, it was extremely, extremely close to Marx.
In terms of like state production or controlling the means of production?
In terms of that, but you know, they had different forms of it. There were different tiers, and you would be able to learn, say, the real motives only as you got closer to the center.
Like Scientology.
Like Scientology, yeah. But you know, just like communism, a lot of the people on the outer tiers thought they were joining a religious, like Christian type, just organization. They thought they were getting involved with something that was for the good of humanity.
Wait, so you know, communism originally was pitched as a religious type spiritual movement?
It was. There were different factions, yes. Some of them did, but I'm not getting into that yet.
That's crazy, because in Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto, they specifically talk about destroying religion.
Right. So that comes a little bit later. I can get into that. Okay. Specifically, what I was talking about just now was, Adam Weishaupt. Adam Weishaupt was raised by Jesuits. He kind of rebelled against the Jesuit system, but he did incorporate kind of their militant stance in accomplishing their goals.
He's sort of 1700s.
Yeah, he's 1700s. What he talked about was, just like Marx, this idea of the stages of society, you know, starting with kind of the primitive communism, ending with this kind of utopian view of returning to the
attaching
state of
evolution to how society progresses.
Kind of.
Well, Darwin didn't come out until like a century after that, I guess.
When Marx came out, Marx did use Darwin, but he did not base it on Darwin. Okay. There were letters exchanged between Marx and Engels talking about, hey, this guy just came out and we can use this to give a scientific backing to our theories of social evolution.
Okay.
You know, so they used Darwin. They posted pictures of Marx and Darwin, drawn together all over Europe and stuff like that. They used him as kind of the scientific base for communism.
So what you're basically saying is, before Marx and Engels, there was basically a bunch of like proto-communist ideologies and philosophies that existed that were involved in the French Revolution and various other attempts to overthrow social orders that Marx one day would later coalesce into a single,
what we know as communism? There was a direct line to it. So Adam Weishaupt's ideas were kind of brought into the Cercle Sociale. There were other groups brought into it. You had all these enlightened thinkers like Voltaire and Rousseau who introduced similar concepts.
Wait, Voltaire was a commie?
Voltaire's ideas had a huge influence on communism, yes.
Interesting.
If you read Voltaire's letters, his letters of what he actually intended to do were much different than what he writes in, you know, his surface books.
Okay, because I've read some of his like satire.
Yeah.
And it's funny.
Yeah.
But you probably don't think so.
Voltaire, his biggest thing was he hated Christianity. He hated Catholicism, which, I mean, you have to understand the social environment at the time that basically, you know, the Catholic Church was kind of one of the governing bodies of Europe. The Inquisition was still taking place in Spain. You know, it was a very different environment from what we understand now. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the revolutionists during that time viewed religion as being also a part of government, which they sought to overthrow.
Okay. So they, like, some of them just hated the religion, and that led them into these communist type organizations.
Well, yeah, but when you get into the groups like the Cercle Sociale, you had some really freaky individuals in there. Like, there were some who I think actually did have more lofty ideas. There were some who probably did have better meaning intentions. And there were some who were just like totally sick in the head. The guy who first came up with the word communism, his nickname was the pornographer. And he based the idea on, like, it sounds crazy, but it was this like theory of like universal animal sexuality and stuff. The guy was one of the sickest little dudes you'll ever read. I researched this stuff. I had to go read some of his stuff. He was obsessed with like incest and all kinds of freaky stuff. You name it, he was into it. And he envisioned this system of like the prostitute system as being a system of governance, basically. The government of the brothel is his whole vision.
How would that work? Is that getting off on a tangent?
Getting on a tangent. But basically, now during the French Revolution, you had these groups come in. You had the Girondins. You had the Montagnards. You had groups who took in these ideas of Greek democracy, of Greek republicanism, right, who all joined together. And then you had this kind of enlightened thinkers who were actively trying to destroy religion, who wanted to destroy tradition, who wanted to wipe out everything that once existed. You had occult groups involved in it, who were a lot of it pulled from old Gnostic beliefs, mainly like Cainite type stuff.
Which means?
Like naturism. But naturism is being different from the way we'd understand it, like during the Roman Empire, like with the Stoic. You
know, how do we understand naturism?
So this is my kind of analysis. I'd break naturism down into three categories. One would be like the kind of what I would say the good system. Well, the two good systems, I'd say, which would be like the kind of ancient Roman/Greek view and the Chinese view. Naturism, according to the Chinese theory, would be more like Taoism, that the belief that the universe itself has a natural order to it, and that abiding by this natural order is itself a positive way of living.
So this is sort of like Japanese Shintoism or some of the Native American folk religions.
And so then if you get into, say, Marcus Aurelius, you know, Epictetus, these guys, they also talked about nature and living in accordance with nature. That, you know, one of the ideas of virtue was, you know, when we talk about, say, the founding fathers, right, the pursuit of happiness and things like that. Virtue and happiness were kind of the same concept in ancient Greece. And so a lot of people who studied the classics, a lot of classical education was based in this, would kind of have this idea that virtue and the practice of virtue and following what is natural, and that, you know, so Aristotle's entire ethics was based on this idea of what truly makes a person happy, that there is joys of the body and there are joys of the soul, and that joys of the soul are the things that are not tied to, say, you know, overemphasis on physical pleasure, that the joys of the body are damaging to the joys of the soul. And, you know, the whole Stoic mentality also was like understanding that life is temporary and to be unmoved by the trials in life, to look within when encountering hardships was actually like a part of, say, finding happiness. So when they talked about naturism, it was very similar to the Taoist concept of naturism. But when you get into the old Gnostic systems, now, there was kind of a weird cultural phenomenon that took place in France around this time. And I mean, and there's a lot of weird groups tied into it. I mentioned the Illuminati of Bavaria. One thing they did was they got into the Freemason lodges, and they created additional tiers at the tops of them. Contrary to what a lot of people think, it was not all of the Masons involved in this. I think a lot of the, I mean, who knows these days? Maybe they are all bad. I have no idea.
And but, just for people listening, like this is historically true. Like people, like it is known that there was a group, the Illuminati of Bavaria, and they did try to influence the Masons. This is not the, you know, 4chan Illuminati internet.
No, you can go read their letters and documents. It's all publicly available. So when I researched this, I did not go through any modern books. If I did use a modern book, I traced their sources and read their sources. I don't like basing my understandings on other people's takes on history.
Because I base all my understandings on 4chan.
There you go. So, you know, there were a few different lodges. There was, say, the Grand Orient, the Scottish Rite, you know, these groups. Not all of them were involved in this. From what I get, the Grand Orient and the Scottish Rite were the two main ones involved, whereas the English Lodge was not involved, and the American lodges at the time, at least, were not involved.
All right, so I just, you know, for clarity here, so we're going back. This is before the French Revolution.
Correct.
So, like, sort of mid-1700s, you've got all these groups that are starting to come together and, like, influence each other, come up with sort of put their sort of proto-communist ideas together. Is that
basically. What they did was is they took – there was a kind of a system in vogue in France that, you know, people wanted to hear whatever belief you could find from whatever country you could find it in. They wanted to hear every theory from every part of the world. They wanted to look into – you know, mysticism and magic and all these things.
Sounds like the U.S. in the 60s.
Yeah, well, you know, in the U.S., there was a big movement around, like, the 30s and stuff, late 1800s to, like, the 30s that were into this, too. But, you know, in Europe, this was a real big thing. It was, you know, mysticism and hermeticism and all these things. People
were
pulling
for alternatives to what was the mainstream Western cultural.
Yeah, because at the time there was a social, you know, any kind of social revolt was not just against the kings of Europe, but also against the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so they were all looking to kind of build their own beliefs.
Because, like, they didn't like the sort of level of governance and social control by the Catholic Church. So they're also kind of rejecting the belief system behind that.
Correct, yeah. And I mean, I should be clear, too. I mean, I don't have anything against the Catholic Church. I'm just talking about history and kind of what I've read on these individuals and what they believed in, right? Voltaire was extremely, extremely, say, vile towards the idea of the Catholic Church.
Which was part of his fascination with China, I know, that he used China as an example. Like, look, this is a thriving civilization that is based off of Confucianism, has nothing to do with Christianity, and it functions. So therefore, Christianity is not something fundamental to a civilization.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with that. I think the ancient Chinese model was great. It didn't have government below the county level. You know, you had a strong culture of allowing people to choose how they live their lives while at the same time maintaining a system of social order. I think it was fair for them to look at that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also they were into this whole naturist idea. But I should get back into the idea of naturism. So naturism, in accordance with what they came up with during the Enlightenment, was a new idea. And it brought together a lot of, you know, there were a lot of different occult groups that, you know, the church was fighting against. I don't want to get into this whole history because it would go on all day if we try to get into all this. But, you know, there were different Gnostic sects. There were witchcraft groups. There were all kinds of crazy stuff. And, you know, of course, we know that the Inquisition was targeting these groups. There were sometimes tens of thousands of them, you know, large numbers. It was very prominent in Europe at that time. And what they came up with was an idea of naturism based on the idea that, so nature itself is holy, and so anything that arises from human nature is therefore righteous. And because of that, anything that restrains human nature is therefore righteous. And so moral restraints, cultural systems, beliefs, traditions, they wanted to destroy all of these because they believed that by destroying them, they would remove restraints on human nature and allow unrestrained human nature to again align with this whole idea of naturism as they envisioned it.
Okay, so this, you mean they're saying that restraints on human nature were unrighteous, according to that belief?
According to this. And I mean, if you want to get technical, this is actually a satanic, Luciferian belief that had kind of gotten to these.
Well, I mean, that's jumping pretty deep into it.
Yeah. Well, that's the basis of a lot. That's the basis of the whole Luciferian concept, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want you to sound like Alex Jones here. So, like, because you mentioned Luciferian, like, I think – no, but I think that this deserves an explanation because presumably this is not just you describing it this way but based on something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, go read about the Cainites. I mean
you can look at the well, I don't necessarily recommend this, but if you go to the Church of Satan's website, they're like their version of the Ten Commandments basically say what you have said, that, you know, that anything that restricts what did you say, human
– anything that restricts human desires or human, you know, nature essentially, right?
It's all
– and so this idea of naturism as they saw it was incomparably different to the way the ancient Greeks and Romans and the ancient Chinese viewed it, you know, more like the Taoist system. And so you had these groups come together and launch a revolution. The revolution – the French Revolution was a mess. I mean, really. And I think that's why a lot of people can't understand it. The biggest part that I think stands out for most people is the Reign of Terror, when he had the guillotine, you know, chopping people's heads off 24/7, which they saw as like this new humane way to kill people.
Yeah, know? At the time. Yeah. They didn't know that the head stays alive for
they learned that later, yeah.
Yeah. But beyond the killings, the French Revolution also sought to radically change the culture of France.
And so this is, I think, the way we should understand it in relation to, say, the American Revolution. The American Revolution was a overthrow of a government they did not believe represented the, you know, rights of the people, that they believed had become a system that was persecuting, you know, the people, that was tyrannical. And so they sought to create a new system which had the belief that the individual is imbued with a certain right, that individuals, if left to be able to choose for themselves how they live their lives, to govern themselves, to form communities, and to come together to build the things they need as they need them, that they would be able to build a prosperous society. And keep in mind, people argue with slavery. Slavery was brought here by the British. Let's be clear on that. You know, and then by the Portuguese and, you know, Spaniards.
Well, so roughly what you're saying is that, like, the forces behind the French Revolution, or they wanted to break from the traditional social order, They were talking about something very different than what the American founding fathers did, even though they also were breaking a traditional system.
So, right, but I mean, what I understand about the French aristocracy at the time, ahead of the French Revolution, is that it had become very wasteful and very corrupt, very disconnected from the lives and the needs of the average French citizen.
That was the way it was framed. But and that is only because it's understood that way historically, because a lot of the newspapers at the time were controlled by these movements. If you look at the, you know, who were running these newspapers, almost all these movements ran their own newspapers, and they also promoted a lot of disinformation in the society.
Right. I mean, also history is usually written by the winners.
Yeah.
Just so, like, you know, in America, we have our version of the great founding fathers, and if, you know, you ask you know, one of my friends from the UK, I asked him about it. He's like, oh, yeah, I mean, we just – that, you know, that was the year we lost America. Like, no big deal. Like, not really a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so anyways, but if we look at what the French did, it was a totally different – totally, totally different concept. They did not seek to reduce the tyranny of government. They sought to increase the control of government over the people. They didn't look, you know, there were writings at the time that people said that they did not seek to overthrow, you know, kings. They sought to overthrow the common man, right? It was the belief that the individual is not smart enough to choose for themselves how they live their lives. And so we enlightened few must choose for them, on behalf of them, all the minute decisions in their lives. And then, so they started this whole, you know, social engineering, everything they had. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I won't get into the whole Reign of Terror.
Well, that right there actually does strike me as like a common thread throughout the history of communism and the difference in the American system, where there is, in the American system, freedom for people to choose, versus in the communist system, giving more and more power to the government, to the central authorities.
Right. I think actually what I would say defines in a lot of ways the American system is the belief that individual people who are unknowable individuals in the context of government, but just like the general faith that the average human being is competent enough and ethical enough to be able to make good decisions on behalf of himself and his family and his community.
As long as they were white landowning men at the time.
That was, keep in mind, this, like, slave owners were like, what, like 1%?
It was a much smaller thing than people think.
And that was a leftover, of course, you know, the British system of mercantilism, you know.
So we can still blame the British.
We can still blame the British.
Because that's important to me.
Which I prefer doing, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I never thought about that, but yeah, that's what I'm going to do now.
Yeah. Blame the British?
Yeah.
For really everything.
Makes sense.
It's why we overthrew them, right?
Yeah.
Also, that and all those stupid spellings. Color with a U? I mean, come on, people.
America truly did improve the system. Yeah. All right, so anyways... all these little secret societies or philosophies that gave rise to the French Revolution.
Yeah, and so you actually had, it was a very interesting, you had a moderate group and you had a very extreme group. There were the Montagnards and the Girondins. The Montagnards ended up killing all the Girondins, right?
And they were the, were they the extreme ones?
Yeah, they were both kind of extreme, but they were more extreme. And after that, they started what was called the Cult of Reason. And the Cult of Reason was a movement. They had the de-Christianization movement under the Cult of Reason. Basically, the Cult of Reason was the first government-run system of atheism. It was worshiping reason in place of, you know, the belief in God.
Now, in your mind, is this different than the American system of separating church and state?
Well, you know, I would say all systems of law are based in a religious foundation. That morality is inseparable from religion. Which is why even when you get into the idea of atheism, right, their atheism was based in naturism, right? The belief that you should not have morals, that moral restraint in and of itself is illogical because who's to say what's right and wrong if there is no God, right? That was kind of the idea.
Wait, so I'm confused by this point. So you're saying that the foundation of this belief was that anything that restricts human nature is bad and get rid of it. But at the same time, they don't want the common people to have freedom, that they want to be completely restrained. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, it doesn't. It's illogical. I mean, just on, you know, honestly, it's totally illogical. And you know, people pointed out how illogical it was. But you had a bunch of, like, you know, 25-year-old basically college kids launching a revolution in the society. Some of them were older, of course.
So basically, they shouldn't have any restrictions on them.
Yeah.
But they should decide the restrictions for everyone. Well,
but you shouldn't restrict them from being able to oppress people.
Exactly.
Ah, there you go. Matt cracked the code. It's all clear now. Yeah. So they started the de-Christianization movement. I mean, you can still find plaques on French buildings, the Cult of Reason. Paintings of it still, pictures of it still. You know, they took prostitutes and put them in the seats of the popes. They would kill priests and so on. They put farm animals in the robes of priests, and you know, they engaged in such extreme debauchery that even Robespierre, who was in charge at that time, was horrified by it. Robespierre then launched his own cult. It was the cult of
slightly more reasonable people.
It was the cult of the supreme being, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And there are different views on this. Some say the cult of the supreme being was a deist system, so just, you know, believe in something. Mm-hmm. Right? Believe in a deity. Others say that Robespierre put himself as God in the seat of God. And if you look at pictures of or paintings of the Cult of the Supreme Being, you can see that he made a mountain and put a big throne at the top and dressed in like Greek god robes and sat on the throne there. So
Sounds like a great guy.
It's a fair analysis. Long story short, all this stuff fell apart. They ended up killed Robespierre. They rebelled against him. And then you had kind of the gradual downfall of the French Revolution. The whole thing failed. It went back to, monarchy and then so on with Napoleon and such. Mm-hmm. But you had different groups that tried continuing the idea of the revolution. So the first revolutionary communist came out of this. It was François-Noël Gracchus-Babeuf. And he tried launching his whole, I think it was called the Conspiracy of Equals. That failed. They got caught. They end up executing him.
I just like how at the time people were naming their own things like the cult of blank or the conspiracy of blank. Yeah. Right? It's like they just like owned those names, right?
Yeah, there was all conspiracy and what. That's true. That basically his ideas were adopted then into the League of Outlaws. It was an organization that meant to kind of carry on his revolutionary ideas.
And so now we're into the 1800s?
This is like early 1800s,
but
yes.
Still pre-Marx.
Pre-Marx. Early 1800s, pre-Marx.
But like Napoleonic Wars era.
Yeah, Napoleonic Wars era, correct. That later became the League of the Just. And you had an individual come into it.
The League of the Outlaws became the League of the Just.
They just changed their name.
That's good branding.
That is good branding.
But at that time, you had a really weird figure come in. And I honestly, I'm kind of vague on what he actually believed in. I can assume what he believed in based on what others around him believed in. But if you read books that describe him, they say that he believed in an apocalyptic Christian worldview.
And this is who believed in it?
The individual took over the League of the Just. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. You look up the League of the Just. It's all public information. This merged later with the Communist League. Karl Marx was in it, so on. It was from there that they wrote the Communist Manifesto.
Wait, so there was a Communist League before Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto?
Correct. Correct.
Really?
Well, communism, as I mentioned, the word came actually from the Cercle Social. And really until Lenin's revolution, right, in the 1917, the words communism and socialism were interchangeable. People used them interchangeably.
Well, we're going to have to get to that later.
Wow. I did not know they were interchangeable.
Yeah. It's just different stages of it. There were no socialist or communist systems before any of this.
This is all just basically theory until, I guess, the Paris Commune of 1871?
It was theory until the Paris Commune, correct.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely get into the socialism versus communism thing a little later in the podcast, because that's a good thing. But so there's this League of Communists.
Well, so there was an interesting break if you read about communism at that time. There were a lot of different groups. I mean, I've read about some of the meetings they had between, say, the Illuminist groups and the socialist groups and all these things. They had somewhere around a million members. I mean, it was not a minor movement. They had a lot of people involved with this. And there were different factions. Marx's faction was looking to create an atheistic version of communism. There were other ones that wanted to create a religious version of communism.
When you say Marx's faction, do you mean a faction led by Marx?
A faction led by Marx, okay. Yeah. And, Marx and Engels. Engels was a Hermeticist. He had studied Hermeticism and things like this. He was quite different from Marx in terms of belief, but Marx's idea of pure materialism ended up being the one they went with. There was another faction, for example.
I mean, Marx really does get all the credit.
Yeah, he does. Well, he was the one who standardized the system that went on to create all the various communist varieties as we've seen them. Mm-hmm. His was the model. Who knows, maybe these other factions have done other things that history just doesn't know about, but for the most part, Marx united all these different factions under a single ideology.
So Marx was kind of like the bottleneck, that all of these different ideologies came together through him. He focused it, and then after him, it would spread out into different variations of his theories.
Basically, Marx popularized it. He united the movements and popularized it. And even the Communist Manifesto, some people argue, wasn't necessarily written by him, because the League of the Just and the League of Outlaws also had their own manifestos, which were very similar. And even going back to the Illuminati of Bavaria, the writings of Adam Weishaupt are really, really similar to Marx, which is pretty interesting. I mean, I don't know if you want to go read this filthy stuff.
So Marx just redistributed the ideas to himself.
Basically. Yeah, but there was some weird stuff. One of the factions, the Communist Church, which was opposed as kind of the alternative.
Oxymoron.
I like that, but okay.
If you read it, it's almost funny. They had the priest of communism and the bishops of communism. It had everything, normal religion had, but everything had communist at the end of it. They had communist sermons and communist hymns and all
communist
these things.
Communist Eucharist.
The freakiest thing, though, is if you read the actual writings of the Church of Communism, which was kind of, the main system that was challenging the Marxist ideas, that it was a Satanist idea. And it actually talked about leading communism into, quote, the final synthesis of God into Satan. Like, it says that. And, you know, really? I mean, I remember reading this, and I'm like, you know, it's like super, like, normal academic writings you're reading.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, all of a sudden they say that, and you're like, what? What the heck am
I
looking
at? People back
here,
then, like, their worldviews were totally different from ours, so they're talking about things.
Yeah, well, you know, I have some, you know, I've talked to some people who are, like, you know, read about, you know, this hermetic text and things like that, and apparently it does come up with some kind of hermetic concept that they believe that somehow, you know, so Carl, I mean, getting into, say, more modern philosophy, Carl Jung, for example, believed that the shortcoming of Christianity, for example, was the idea that it did not integrate the shadow, that it denied the dark side of human nature entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of groups that talked, you know, Carl Jung, for example, talked about integrating the shadow, right? Mm-hmm. You identify the nature of the shadow self and the you know, the light self, and you find a middle ground beneath the two, and through that balance you can find, say, you know, a higher self. That was the idea. And if you get into, like, even like Kabbalah and stuff like that, you know, the tree of life breaks and then reemerges and things like this. They believe that the left-hand path and the right-hand path essentially led to the same final goal. And so good and evil, in a lot of their eyes, was different paths to the same final point.
This is beginning to sound like Star Wars to me.
Well, this is all these creepy occult things that are at the basis of this, if you get into all of it. Anyways, that's all moot, though, because basically Marx's system is the one they settled on.
Mm-hmm.
And what Marx kept was, a lot of people think that it was just an economic system, which it wasn't. It was a culture. It was cultural. It was spiritual. It was everything.
Well, but it's interesting you're describing it like a church, right? Because in the Communist Manifesto that Marx and Engels wrote, they basically say communism, this is a quote, "Communism abolishes eternal truths. It abolishes all religion and all morality."
Yeah.
But I think what Josh is saying, that there was a separate church of communism that was trying to go down a different route, and then there was Marx's.
Well, yeah, because it wasn't necessarily atheistic until Marx kind of finalized the atheistic view of it. I mean, if there were any atheistic system, it was more a rebellion against Christianity, such
and the
as
dominant
such,
Catholic Church.
Yeah, and then merging in these different occult ideas, such as with, like, the, you know, the cult of reason, for example. And so, you know, you talk about Engels, for example. He was, you know, he'd studied Hermeticism and things like that. A lot of them had. If you get into you know, the whole, you know, Hegel and stuff like that. He was also a Hermeticist. One of the main foundations of communism, the living soul of Marxism, as I think it's been called, is dialectical materialism. Dialectical materialism is extremely, extremely important into understanding what communism actually aims to do and how it creates its systems. And so dialectical materialism was actually, they took the Hegelian dialectic, right, which is observing, say, a process in motion, right? Thesis, synthesis. I can't remember how they described it. But the main idea that Marx kept from it was the idea that conflict leads forward. Conflict leads forward, so if you manufacture conflict in society or struggle in society, you thereby help society advance. And Marx believed in this idea of proposed this idea of social evolution, you know, the five stages of civilization, which is very similar to, like, Thomas Cole's Course of Empires, for example.
And this is when he starts kind of synthesizing in some of what Darwin was researching, survival of the fittest.
This is when they started bringing that in, yeah.
Okay.
So Marx's five stages of civilization, you had primitive communism, the agrarian society, capitalism. At the time, there was nothing beyond that. Then he believed that eventually the people, you know, the workers would revolt. They'd seize for themselves control of the whole thing, and they'd establish the dictatorship of the proletariat, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they would, this new system would seize control of all the means of production. Which is funny, because a lot of people these days, they think that socialism is an alternative to capitalism, which it, you know, if you understand the five stages of civilization, yes, it kind of was, but it didn't ever talk about getting rid of the capitalist systems. Lenin, I mean, they all wrote about this. Lenin, for example, wrote about how socialism was the system of state capitalist monopoly. It was not that they would get rid of the systems of trade as we understand them, but that the state would seize control of them.
So it's the same thing, just different people controlling it.
It's the same thing. It's just that the quote, the people no longer control it, which is funny because they talked about the people controlling it. It's a state dictatorship seizes control of it, the average person is no longer able to engage in it, right? Unless they're assigned by the state to engage in it.
So you wouldn't, in this worldview, you wouldn't have like the rich capitalist controlling a factory.
Well, you'd have the rich communist party cadre
in
controlling
practice,
the factory.
In practice, yeah. But they didn't talk about that.
Yeah, and then the peons getting whatever they decide to trickle down through their bureaucracy.
Yeah. So this dialectical materialism.
Right. So anyways, but they believed that the final stage after they actually socialism was not really meant to last, though. This is what's really interesting when you understand communism. Socialism was not designed to last. Socialism was a state of dictatorship. It was a system where the government seizes control of every element of society and uses that control to destroy within that society all the things that communism aimed to destroy: morality, religion, tradition, beliefs, the financial systems of independence, the family structure, you name it.
So at this point, I do just want to throw in, like, the argument there is like, well, if you look at the Scandinavian countries or even some European countries, you don't see like the government of Norway rounding up political prisoners and executing them.
Right. So the whole Scandinavian or whatever the Nordic model thing is a total nonsense. It's a lie. Look at Denmark, for example. They're not socialist countries. It's true they have high taxation and they have free healthcare and free school. But they still have the full system of capitalism. I mean, they're still absolutely capitalist societies. And actually, they're more capitalist than even the U.S. You go to Denmark, it's super easy to start a business. They don't even have minimum wage laws, which is funny because they have like one of the highest, wages in the world, I think.
Interesting. All right. Well, so we'll get back to that socialism-communism thing. I just wanted to throw that in there because I want to hear about what dialectical materialism means.
So dialectical materialism, it's called like the living soul of Marxism. Dialectical materialism.
Okay, so what you were saying was that socialism is not built to last.
Socialism is not built to last. It was meant to seize control of every element of society and to use that control to drive society towards the final synthesis of communism. The final synthesis being this idea of a society totally, quote unquote, liberated from all its forms of slavery. So Marx would call morality slavery on the human spirit.
He called it a form of slavery.
Family was slavery. Every restraint on human nature, anything that would make a preconceived idea about what reality was, right? They wanted to destroy all of that, traditional values, belief, culture, so on. And, just so happens every communist society has done this, right? They always aim to destroy these things. And even, I'd say, the open socialist systems, they take steps to accomplish this as well. They start attacking the traditions and beliefs and religious foundations of the society, although it's much slower a lot of times.
What do you mean by an open socialist society? Well, are you talking about Venezuela?
I'm saying like the democratic socialists, I guess we can call them. The socialists who use the, say, elected forms of government to achieve their goals rather than, say, violent revolution where they can immediately seize control of every element of society.
Okay, well, then Venezuela, right? Because they used, Hugo Chavez was democratically elected, and then he began seizing some of the means of production, right? So he sees PDVSA, the oil company. He sees some of the other things, set price maximums on things and so on.
He tried to get term limits removed, the people actually voted against that. And then you see what happened with Maduro and everything else.
Yeah, and there you have it. Yeah, okay, history repeats itself yet again.
But legitimately, we would call that a socialist system in the sense that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that would be socialist. And I mean, technically, if you go by Marx's views, actually a lot of real communists are right in saying that we haven't really seen, quote-unquote, true communism. We've seen the variants of socialism to varying extremities. None of them achieved the goals that Marx claimed they would achieve, which would in his eyes be communism.
Well, but let's talk about China, because of course this is China Unscripted.
Hold on, I don't want to jump to China yet. There's just, like, we haven't even really talked about dialectical materialism or what happened after Marx.
So dialectical materialism was based on the thing they kept from the Hegelian dialectic was the idea that conflict leads forward. And dialectical materialism is the way that communism manufactures its issues in each society it creates. In each society, it's trying to manifest itself. So you can understand every country in the world has its own religion. Every country in the world has its own social values, its own, you know, cultural standards, its own beliefs, its own, you know, variant system of government. Communism, in order to get into these countries, uses dialectical materialism. And dialectical materialism uses three different steps: identify, contradict, eliminate the middle. It is a, you know, if you want to get in again into the origins of communism, it's a satanic concept. It's a concept based in inversion. So Satanism, for example, inverts the moral systems of Christianity. If you, you know, I mean, not maybe not these clowns with Church of Satan, these kinds of guys, but like real Satanists, right? Like real, you know, the legit ones. You know, they look to invert morality. So whatever the Christians teach, they seek to do the opposite. If you want to talk about the Ten Commandments, they will seek to violate the Ten Commandments. They hold a black mass, they hold it in reverse, they read things in reverse, everything's upside down, inverted, right?
Okay.
And I mean, technically you could use this to create an evil interpretation of anything, right? The values, systems that challenge the inherent values of the society. If you want to get into the, you know, scientific view of it, right? They talk about magic, you know, dark magical systems, for example, the anthropology, right? That there's type 1 and type 2, criminal magic, as they would call it. Not magic as we would think, like wizards and stuff, but magic is in things that affect the human consciousness. So beliefs, for example, or religion.
Okay.
Type 1 criminal magic would be things like, say, Christianity during the time of Rome and, you know, these things. Its beliefs challenged the incumbent beliefs of that society. And so the society called it criminal because it challenged the beliefs of that society. That does not mean it was evil. It made people question what they believed in. It challenged the values that society had. That was type 1 criminal magic. Type 2 criminal magic is what they call left-hand path systems. It is the inversion of the moralities of the society itself, not a unique one, but the intentional taking of the values of that society, flipping them upside down, and using that to agitate and destroy the systems of that society.
Okay, so for example, use the example of the early Christians. The early Christians were not necessarily trying to invert the culture of Rome. They were just a different system.
Incorrect. And because people saw their ideas as reasonable, some people were converting and people weren't happy that someone was challenging, you know, their kind of incumbent beliefs and culture, right? Doesn't mean it was evil. But from the standpoint of those incumbent beliefs, it was something that challenged them, and so they would regard it as criminal or evil. That was a, you know, exactly, you know, we'd call an anthropology, right? Type 1 criminal magic. Type 2 criminal magic being the actual inversion of the moral systems of that society. And so Satanism to Christianity would be type 2 criminal magic, or what they call left-hand path systems.
Hmm.
And so dialectical materialism worked totally on this left-hand path concept. It was, you take any society, any culture in the world, and you flip it upside down. If you want, I mean, it's all unfortunately tied to social movements these days, right? If you want to, say, attack the religion of the society, you promote things that go against the values of that religion in the society. If people believe lying is wrong, you start a campaign of lies, like they did in communist China, right?
But like they openly start a campaign of lies.
Yeah, openly, right? If let's say, you know, the society is based in the idea that people can start their own business and have free trade, you create arguments in that society that you should not have any free trade, right? You create the opposite extreme.
Oh, I'm kind of thinking of like in the China's Cultural Revolution, like because in China for thousands of years there's the idea of respecting your elders, respecting your teachers. And like in the Cultural Revolution, suddenly it was like the students were, you know, exposing their teachers, beating up their teachers.
Educating their teachers.
Right, right.
Often with their fists.
Yeah. Or, you know, the whole, you know, ancient Chinese society was based on, you know, harmony of man and nature. Communism talked about, you know, fighting with man, fighting with, you know, God. Therein lies true joy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was right. That was something Mao said, right?
Yeah, that was Mao Zedong.
So Mao really latched on to this. dialectical materialism.
I would actually say that Mao Zedong, of all the communist leaders, seemed to understand it best. And he actually...
So really, Mao Zedong was the best communist.
Technically. If you understand his use of the socialist system, technically the only one that really tried to directly create communism is they envisioned it, I should say, would be like Pol Pot, where they threw everyone out into the fields and tried to make them return to like agrarian, you know, absolute agrarian society or something.
What's interesting you say that.
Even pre-communism was... Communism would have been even beyond agrarianism.
The primitive communism,
yeah.
Well, so it's interesting you say that Mao was the best communist, because I know one of the criticisms of, like, the Soviet communist was that, you know, the idea that society progresses along these five avenues, and, like, society has to reach a capitalist system before you can truly have the communist uprising. China was still mostly an agrarian society, so they felt you couldn't have a true communist uprising until China had gone through the industrial capitalist phase.
Yeah, well, it's complicated. Yeah, that's an interesting point, though, that maybe the whole opening up thing was actually just part of that. but who knows?
Well, no, really? But I mean, one of the things that Mao did, which was what the Soviets were like, you can't get the farmers on board, and Mao's like, no, we've got, you know, hundreds of millions of farmers. We're going to use them as the proletariat to overthrow the landlords and the existing structure.
So in the sense that was, I guess what you're saying about inverting and attacking, that was communism. But in the strictest sense of it was not an industrial proletariat, it wasn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is an important thing to mention, is that a lot of people, it's easy to try to understand communism only through the lens of, say, the financial systems and the whole capitalist, you know, market type stuff. That was a really small part of communism. The only reason they used that was because doing so allowed them to seize control of that society.
Well, so it seems like you're saying what's core to it is conflict, specifically through inversion.
Exactly.
How is that different than the kind of conflict that's been going on in all human history?
Because communism directly aims to incite conflict. Mm-hmm. Socialism, as we can understand it, cannot exist unless people are told to struggle against a certain group of people. It always works by identifying, let's say, an oppressor in a society and driving society into struggle against that group you've identified.
And that's different than the founding fathers saying we need to struggle against the British monarchy.
Yeah, it wasn't an ongoing struggle. Communist, they didn't say, I don't think they said struggle.
They didn't use struggle, but I'm like...
Yeah. No, I mean,
laying it on.
That was against, I think. I mean, you can say there were past revolutions in all points of society. There were wars in all points of society, all of whom believed they were fighting for some kind of just cause. I mean, presumably, I'm sure there were some who said, you know, we're evil, we're going to go eat them or something. You know? I'm sure there were some like that too, like barbarian tribes or something like that, I'm sure.
Not the barbarians.
but you know, presumably a lot of them believed they were doing something just and believed they were fighting against some kind of injustice. In ancient China, for example, they said, right, the people follow the emperor follows heaven. But if you believed the emperor was not following heaven, you were totally right to overthrow him.
Well, right? Weren't a lot of communist revolutions based on the idea that society is unequal, that it is unjust, and we're going to overthrow these old systems to create a more just society?
That was the talking point they used. But what did they put in its place? They had this idea that any evil, any degree of crime is acceptable in achieving our goals. They talked about liberating humanity from slavery, but communism is through and through the ideology of slavery. They enslaved entire societies. If you control every single part of a person's life, every decision they have, and you threaten to throw them in prison if they don't want to do it, that is slavery. What is slavery? It's a person who works and is not entitled to the revenue of their you know, what they produce, right? Mm-hmm. That they're not able to have what they produce. Communism is based on that. That is the basis of communism. I mean, one of the bases of communism.
That the government controls every facet of a person's personal life.
Or that you are not entitled to the fruits of your labor, which mm-hmm. is the same idea as slavery. And also that if you try to escape, we'll kill you, which we've also seen in a lot of communist societies.
Yeah.
You know?
Even if you don't try to escape.
Yeah, they might just kill you anyways. It's true. And so, you know, they use talking points. But you have to understand this is how the dialectic works. the dialectic. Now, Marx was very good at this. I'd say Marx and Mao are the two who really got it.
Eminem.
Yeah. Marx was very good at, say, using inversion in everything he did. So, you know, he would say, you know, there was a book that said, what was it? I mean, I'll just give kind of a random example. You know, someone would say we must stop the tyranny of the intellectual, and Marx would say we must stop the intellectual of the intellectualism of tyranny. You know, right? Things like this. He would take things and just flip them upside down. If you read a lot of his writings, sometimes in his letters with Engels, he would talk about articles he had written for various newspapers. And Engels would inquire, oh, well, what was your prediction on what would the outcome of this issue be? And Marx would say, well, I wrote it in a way that no matter what happens, I'd be correct.
So it's like a TV psychic.
Yeah, TV psychic.
It kind of reminds me of, like I read Mao's Little Red Book. Mm-hmm. When I was traveling in China a long time ago. And one of the things that really struck me is there'd be things like, you know, people accuse me of, you know, being a rascal. And that's precisely what I am, you know. And people accuse me of using the scum of society. But that's exactly what we're doing. And he kind of like takes something that should be a criticism and then flips it upside down to be like – he like totally owns it and then – uses it as if it's it begs the question, though. Well, I mean, the technical sense begs the question. Like it assumes the premise of the thing to be correct before he says it, and then he says it, and then it's like repeated over and over again, and people just like believe it.
Yeah.
Basically. So an example is like how, well, definitely in the Soviet Union and in China, you know, in general, people think being educated is good. But in these societies, it became that, oh, if you're educated, if you're an intellectual, that means you have somehow gotten that because you're oppressing people and you're using your intellect to further oppress people. So
go to the countryside, you know, revolutionary. People would get like fleas in their hair and they call them revolutionary fleas, right? Because being dirty was like the highest
state. Yeah, Mao called it revolutionary bugs and people would actually just not bathe. So it is that thing where it's like something traditionally viewed as good, like being intellectual, then gets flipped into being something bad.
Yeah, and so Mao Zedong, like I said, I think he understood this better than pretty much any of them, other than maybe Marx himself. Mm-hmm. Mao Zedong talked about it almost as an inverted Taiji theory, and so Taiji or Yin Yang, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. The idea that there are two opposing forces in the universe which harmonize with each other and bring balance to each other.
Which is a very traditional concept, the idea of order and chaos, et cetera, et cetera.
Mao Zedong talked about it differently. He said one becomes two, two becomes four. So imagine a Tai Chi, there's yin and yang, and suddenly yin and yang break from each other. One becomes two, right? You have two separate things, yin and yang separate. And then two becomes four. Each of those is now split in two.
Factional infighting.
And the idea is not just to break or destroy the values of a society, but to disintegrate them layer by layer. And so when a lot of people who study, communism in the critical sense, they talk about, or even the positive sense, right? The people who like it, they talk about using the dialectic. And so part of the idea of using the dialectic is it's the progress, right? The slow march through the institutions. It's taking things one step at a time. That you may aim to, say, achieve the end goal of destroying a certain value in society, but you might not destroy it outright. You might start by criticizing it. You might start by pushing a social issue that would accomplish the goal of destroying that value in a society, right? And here's the theory, is that most people not wanting to engage in conflict will say, I'm not going to be involved in this, you guys fight it out. The two people who are left are going to be the real hardliners and the communists.
The extremes.
Yeah, the extremes. The hardliners.
Welcome to the internet.
Yeah, the internet.
I was going to say, it sounds like everything happening in politics now.
Yeah. And so you're going to have the people who refuse to give up their beliefs arguing with the communists, and the communists, the people who refuse to give up their beliefs are usually based in some religion or traditional value that the communists are criticizing and attacking from other angles, right? They're trying to dissolve it from other angles. Society is witnessing this. If they can drive the opposing faction or the incumbent faction into, say, getting angry or lashing out, they use that. They latch onto it and say, oh, see what he did? These people do these terrible things and you should all turn against it. Gradually, people will start moving towards one extreme or the other. Chances are usually they move to the, at least historically, they have very often moved towards the communist side. Hmm. And then, you know, because the communists, they don't say what they actually aim to achieve on the surface. A lot of times it does, they you know, give it the veneer of common good, right? Mm-hmm. They want to create a social issue that kind of works as a mask over their true intentions, you see?
You know, what this is reminding me of is like how the American Psychological Association recently, like, came out with new guidelines that said, like, traditional views of masculinity are, like, fundamentally toxic and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea of taking what is, you know, traditionally viewed as being a man, they flip that and make that bad, that men are bad fundamentally, and there needs to be some kind of new approach to it.
Yeah, that's exactly that. And if people don't come out to challenge it, if people don't try to reverse it, right, they just win. It's as simple as that. But I won't get into it just yet, but if we talk about communist tactics of ideological subversion, the first step is demoralization. You want people to no longer fight. You want people to no longer try to challenge them. You want people to become so afraid of being attacked that they just sit and keep their mouths shut. Right?
Yeah, it sounds like the internet.
And you know, they don't want to engage in it because it's stressful. There are more pleasant things you can be focused on. You don't want to be arguing with people over, you know, issues like this. And if you do take, you know, if you do step out, they will attack you in the most vicious ways they can find. At least, you know, that's what communism does, right?
You do see that all throughout the Cultural Revolution and before then. And, yeah.
And YouTube comments.
YouTube comments. There you go. All right. So anyways, where were we? We were with dialectical materialism. Anyways, we'll get into the whole history of how communism developed. Basically, between the start of, the creation of the Communist Manifesto and, let's say, Lenin, there were several attempts by the communists to launch different revolutions, 1848, Paris Commune, and so on, right? Mm-hmm. Marx played a very strong role in these. If not, you can't really prove direct, but you can say ideological, that he was the one uniting these movements under the whole Communist League and was egging them on and providing kind of the ideological backbone and distributing pamphlets and newspapers and books all over Europe, and of course into other parts of the world. This went on basically until World War I happened. And so what happened in World War I? Marx said, workers of the world unite, right? Mm-hmm. Now is our time, right? And what happened? The workers of the world did not unite.
They united along traditional nationalistic lines.
They died of the Spanish influenza.
Yeah.
Or German bullets.
Now, they rallied behind their respective kings, right? The idea that nationalism, the idea that national pride and, you know, heritage and these things, right? It created this idea that this was a more powerful force than the idea of violent revolution, than the idea of, say, the struggle of the workers. And so a lot of communists at that time said, well, what the heck? What the heck just happened? Everything Marx was saying did not come to fruition, right? And so a lot of them are going back to the drawing board. What happened then was something that no one really expected. Lenin did his march on, the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, and it was not the workers against, the bourgeois. It wasn't the proletariat against the bourgeois. It was the intelligentsia and the military against the feudalist, the czarist feudalist system, right? It was
right, but he also took over in the October Revolution, following an earlier revolution that year that didn't really work very well.
Yeah, so yeah, Lenin technically subverted an existing revolution, and he just pretty much walked into the palace and Winter Palace and just took it for himself. His revolution wasn't as fantastic as the Soviets later made it sound.
Are you accusing the Soviets of lying?
But the point is, that incident made a lot of communists go back to the drawing board, basically. So of course, and if you know, we look at what Lenin actually did too. He didn't help the workers. He persecuted the workers. The enemies of his system were the kulaks, the peasants who were well off, the peasants who were successful. One of the first things he did was seized the seeds and, you know, plows and stuff of the peasants so they couldn't grow food, and it started a huge famine. It killed like millions of people.
It wasn't just the weather that caused the famine?
Yeah, maybe a few things combined. Yeah. But
that's what they say about the Great Famine in China, right? The 3 years of bad weather or something like that.
Really? Well, you know, when Lenin was questioned about, you know, killing millions of his people by doing this, what he said was, it's good. I mean, not his exact words, but it's good. He said, it will destroy people's faith not only in the Tsar, but in God, too. And he said that it would also help society move to the next stage, right? They would move from the whole agrarian society to the socialist system.
Right? I'm curious what the source of that is.
Black Book of Communism has it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, read the Black Book of Communism.
How does it compare to the Red Book of Communism?
quite different. One is expectations versus reality. Right. So what happened after Lenin's, you know, after Lenin launched his revolution, you had all these communists go back to the drawing board.
Because World War I did not create the kind of communist revolution people thought, and then Lenin's successful revolution was not done the way it was supposed to.
It wasn't late-stage capitalism. It was, forceful takeover. It wasn't a natural revolt of the working class and so on. The advanced capitalist societies, as they would call it during that time, would have been like Germany and, Britain. And contrary to Marx's belief too, the living quality of living quality of life didn't go down further. It was actually going up. People were becoming more comfortable, more successful. Early industrial revolution was pretty horrific, but by that time it was already improving. And so you had all these communists go back to the drawing board, and they said, okay, well, obviously Marx was wrong. And so a lot of them wrote very critical pieces on Marx at that time, which is what confuses a lot of people when they understand, well, didn't he criticize Marx and so on? Like, because a lot of them did, even like Lenin, for example, right? So what happens, right? You have Mussolini make a new system. Mussolini was one of the top, socialists in Europe at that time. He was extremely well-respected in the socialist community. They turned against him basically because he supported World War I. And so he went off and started his new faction, which was the fascists. Mussolini had witnessed in World War I. His lesson was that, the idea of the workers' revolution wasn't as appealing to people as the nationalist pride, right? Because everyone fought with their kings and stuff. And so he said, well, let's use that as one of the uniting factors of socialism.
That's what turned Mussolini's socialism into Mussolini's fascism.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, the whole fascist concept was the fascisti. It's the sticks that reinforce the handle of the axe. It was a collectivist concept. In his autobiography, which is eloquently my autobiography, he says that under this new system, people will no longer have the antisocial right to rebel against the interests of the collective, right?
Don't rock the boat.
Yeah.
So Mussolini was essentially a communist.
He was. He was a socialist or a communist. But like I said, until Lenin, there was no difference between the two. You could say socialist or communist.
Okay. But at the minimum, he was a socialist who then turned that socialism into fascism.
Correct. And fascism is just, it's the same thing. If you look at Mussolini's policies, and I know people don't like hearing this, look at his policies, it reads like Bernie Sanders.
Whoa.
Honestly, go read them. Go read his policies.
Free college?
I encourage everyone to go read what he is promoting. It's no different from the socialists of today.
Just want to remind everyone listening that the opinions of Josh Philip are his alone. I don't necessarily endorse or dismiss.
Yeah, go read them. Don't take it from my mouth.
Look, Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist. So that's his self-description.
So did Engels. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Engels was the first democratic socialist.
No kidding.
One of them, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, the whole idea of Marxism being separate from stuff was stupid. It was, technically the Paris Commune was democratically elected. It's just after taking power, they went and launched, their attacks on Paris.
I mean, they just destroyed, like, huge amounts of Paris, like the art and the buildings and the...
different estimates, but yeah, they destroyed a ridiculous amount of the arts and buildings.
But anyway, so Mussolini, socialist turned fascist dictator.
Right, and so basically Mussolini did his march on Rome. He didn't really have a violent overthrow. He maintained the king. He kept recognizing the church. There are different beliefs on why he did that. Some say, oh, well, he didn't have the power to fully overthrow it, or it, during that time, wouldn't have been a good idea because he would have probably gotten taken out by other factions of the church or whatever, right? Technically, Mussolini didn't go fully into his socialist system until Hitler gave him control of Salo. Once he gained control of Salo, that's when you saw his full system at play.
So Salo?
Right. That was... Right, the part of what was it, Rome, or sorry, Italy, that Hitler gave to Mussolini fully to play out his whole system.
Okay. Right. So what is Hitler's view? Because Hitler was a fascist.
Hitler was a socialist. It was National Socialism. That's what Nazism is. It's National Socialism. He used the ideas of Mussolini, but also merged them with communism. He was very critical of Marx, but he was critical of Marx in the same context that a lot of them were critical of Marx in the same, at that time. That they believed that the core ideas of socialism and communism could be reworked into a functioning system. Because Marx didn't really propose a real strong system. Marx criticized existing systems, right? They said, our goal is to destroy, not to edify. They did not look to create a replacement for those systems, but to instead destroy all the previously existing systems.
So right? Hitler, one of his things was he promoted German culture, which seems to be at odds with what you're saying. And also, I mean, he was virulently anti-communist, I thought.
He fought the Soviets, certainly. No, he was and he wasn't. He totally aligned with the Soviets. He had different talking points. He claimed to be against Marxism. If you look at his policies, it was absolutely socialist. He used identity politics the same way that modern people use identity politics. His entire basis was, instead of going after the 1%, it was the Jewish wealth, you know, the wealthy Jews. Right, he seized their assets, redistributed it across Europe.
So instead of the patriarchy, it was smash the Jews.
It was the same arguments. If you want to have a fun time, go on any of these Huffington Post and replace any mention of white people with the Jew, and you'll see it reads exactly like something Adolf Hitler would write.
Dear.
You know, the modern people, they're playing the same. They're doing the same exact thing. It's just that when you're in it, it's like they can't see it for what it is. Right, it's the whole idea is dividing society into factions and pitting them against each other.
Matt, can you look up a Huffington Post article and
see if that
works?
Mad Libs with HuffPo.
There's a really funny internet plugin actually that will change the mentions of that for you.
Well, now that's capitalism right there. There's a market demand to replace. Jeez, oh my gosh. Yeah.
Okay, here's an article. This is an opinion article published in the Huffington Post. The title is "White People Stop Using 911 to Oppress Black People." So if we change it to "Jews Stop Using 911 to Oppress the German People,"
yeah, basically,
then that doesn't sound really good.
Go into the article.
all right, I'm going to read it, but I'm just going to replace white people. I'll leave everything else.
I'm going to use this against you someday in the future, Matt.
Okay, so we're reading HuffPo. Here's how it begins. If there's one thing Jews seem to love... Oh, God.
Wow.
If there's one thing Jews seem to love, it's calling the police on black people who are just going about their daily lives.
I'm so uncomfortable. Keep going.
Yeah, no, I can't.
Keep going. A little bit more.
It doesn't say white people that many times, so let me just find a paragraph that – okay. While the media and the public may be fascinated with such stories, Jews calling the police on black people isn't a new phenomenon at all.
You have articles calling for like white genocide these days outright in some of these publications.
I don't know if I've seen that. Sound
familiar?
Here's a good one. We cannot reduce these incidents to misunderstandings or even overreactions. Rather, we must acknowledge them for what they are, acts of Jew supremacist violence.
Wow.
It's crazy that you said that. I thought you were joking about the HuffPo thing. But again, in HuffPo's defense, I'm only looking at the first article I found, and it was an opinion article. Obviously, when you publish an opinion article, you're partly responsible for the content, but partly not totally responsible. The same way we're having you on this podcast, and your views are your own. Although, you know, if you were a completely crazy person and we brought you on, then it would be, well, I should be partly clear. Our fault.
What I oppose is the totalitarian systems.
So you're anti-totalitarian.
Anti-totalitarian. I fully oppose fascism. I fully oppose Nazism. I fully oppose communism and socialism. And I see them as being almost exactly the same.
See, that's just really interesting, because in the context of what I learned in school, you've got when I grew up, so like 80s, 90s, the bad guys were the Nazis. The good guys were the Allies, including America, USA number one. And the communists, well, it's not so bad. It was just the other thing, and that's the second world. And, you know, they have their own system. And the Cold War, I mean, by the time I was in, you know, middle school, the Cold War was over, and communism was kind of done. But they weren't portrayed in the way that the Nazis were.
It's because their crimes were never fully brought out.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Like, why is it, you know, we say, oh, well, you know, Mao killed, you know, up to 100 million people. Stalin killed maybe 40 million. I mean, it's not a competition, but,
you know, verified, we can say at least 100 million. That was Black Book of Communism.
Overall, all communist societies, 100 million have been killed.
According to Black Book of Communism, but more recent research suggests the number is maybe 150 million or more.
So not to downplay the, you know, 6 million Jews that Hitler killed, plus, you know, gypsies and so on.
Not to mention, I think just Lenin's famine killed something like 4 to 5 million Russians.
Right. So, but again, to not downplay the horrible things Hitler did, you're just saying that communism just ended up killing like an order of magnitude more people.
Well, I think Josh would include all of those.
I would include
Nazi
those
kills.
With it. Okay. Yeah. I would include those with it, although the numbers I gave did not include that, because a lot of people don't include this, unfortunately, right? But I would say that even in terms of practice, it's the exact same thing. The entire system revolves around struggle. You want to identify an enemy of the people which people are driven to struggle against, right? Sometimes communism promotes tradition. We saw that under, you know, the whole, what was it, Romanian system, right? Was it...
Ceausescu,
yeah, you know, he brought up this whole idea of, you know, tradition and stuff. It's still regarded as a communist system. It was communism,
right? I mean, Hitler liked traditional Western art. He thought that the art of the European people, Wagner, especially the German people, you know, was like the greatest of all, right? He, you know, Wagner, as you mentioned, although Wagner, I understand, didn't really like his music being used that way, but
no, I think you're thinking of Strauss. Wagner was well before Hitler.
Oh, okay. Sorry, wrong. You're the one with a
master's
degree.
In classical music education.
That's right. But the point is, so Hitler was using these very traditional Western cultural ideas.
It's mixed. If you read Hitler's attacks on Christianity and stuff, it was the same thing as the rest of them, right? You know, he was talking about, you know, German, Nordic, you know, traditions and stuff like that. His attacks on the incumbent religion at that time was no different from any other country. It's just he was using the dialectic differently. He was using it to use the older stuff to attack the newer stuff, you know, so to speak.
So it's like today in China. Well, so it's like China, how there was a whole period where they were big old anti-Confucius. Confucius was horrible, smash, destroy Confucius. And now you have the party backing Confucius Institutes and promoting Confucianism just with its nationalistic twist to it.
Yeah. I would almost say it's like a hollowed out version of Confucianism. Like, it uses the forms of Confucianism. Or like if you go to...
Well, the point is they did both tactics. They were against traditional culture, and now they are also promoting traditional culture, even though it's been subverted.
They've done it a lot of ways. I mean, there was the China Buddha Association, which was the Chinese Communist Party's like state-run version of Buddhism. It was
the Patriotic Catholic Association.
Yeah, there was the whole liberation theology system they used to subvert Latin America, for example, where, you know, Russia's control of the Russian Orthodox Church to, you know, do these things.
Like the World Council of Churches, that was kind of...
Yeah, the World Council of Churches, that was tied into that as well, yeah. You know, it's complicated. This is why it's hard, I think, to understand what communism is without understanding the deeper ideas of the dialectic, right, of dialectical materialism, how it works.
How would you define the dialectic or dialectical?
That everything is taking place. Everything is not necessarily about the surface issues. The surface issues are merely tools to achieve a deeper goal. And the deeper goal is to destroy one value of the society for each specific issue, right? If the goal at any given time is to, say, seize power, then you might say anything. You might support the nationalist movement. You might support groups that oppose communism. You might even claim you're anti-communist just because you want to seize power. You will say anything to seize power because their goal is not the issue. The issue is the tool to achieve the goal.
Okay, so let me ask you to give a specific example. Let's say, Josh, you were a communist and you wanted to use dialectical materialism to destroy China Uncensored. What tactic would you use to achieve that? Because going up against China Uncensored on a basis of factual accuracy, you're probably not going to get anywhere because we're really good about fact-checking, for example.
Yeah, well, I'd say that they've probably tried getting you guys on that and haven't. They're probably trying to use it. The easiest way to do it would be that's not really dialectic. That'd be more like subversion or something like that.
Okay.
I'd rally hundreds of people to go leave negative comments on your comment section, or I'd create new release documents that contradict your reports and then broadcast, and then have foreign agents go talk
make
to foreign media.
Make accusations of racism.
Yeah, accuse. Yeah, exactly. So that, right now, for example, the Committee of 100, one of the Chinese Communist Party's groups, goes into high circles of society, and anytime a Chinese spy is arrested, they say it's racism. They use this, right? The Chinese Communist Party talks. I mean, this is getting away from dialectical materialism, but the Chinese Communist Party talks about strangling you with your own systems. You might want to even push things to an extreme. Right, you want to drive them to an extreme, because anytime something's driven to an extreme, then it becomes questionable, right? And so if you this is the Chinese Communist Party strategy of strangle you with your own systems. Oh, you believe in free speech? Well, I'm going to use free speech to destroy you. I'm going to use it to criticize you on your own soil. Oh, you believe in freedom of the press? I'm going to go to your country and build my own newspaper and use that newspaper to attack everything you claim you stand for.
So this is basically like China Global Television Network, which is the Chinese state-run media that's got, they've got their building that's in Washington, D.C. They're members of the press club. Different Chinese state-run media have taken over various radio stations. They put Chinese propaganda in the China Watch sections that they advertise in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times and so on. And they're taking advantage of the free and open speech environment of this country.
Yeah, pretty much. Or, they might try to get say a volunteer into your organization, for example, who will then, cause trouble from within and then use that as a way to frame you. One of the ways, too, is disinformation. They could have a secret source come and give you, I'm a former top-level official and I have this information for you. And, as soon as you release it, then let's say the grain of falsehood or the way it was taken, for example, might be used to frame a new narrative to attack you on a real large scale. They'll do stuff like that,
So why do you think it is that even today even though communism has communism succeeded anywhere it's been tried?
It hasn't succeeded economically. I would say it has succeeded in really damaging moral values and traditions. If you look at the effects it has had in the Soviet Union in terms of damaging the values that once existed, or China, for example, of like destroying the spiritual heritage or the old traditions of China. Yeah, it succeeded to a horrible extent. People, when they try to understand communism, they make the mistake of looking at it only on in terms of economic success, or does this create financial success. They understand it ironically, this whole capitalist viewpoint, which is kind of funny, I think this is also where a lot of people go wrong when they try to understand it or criticize it. That's a very small part of what it actually aims to do. And when it comes to damaging religion, to destroying culture, to destroying morality, I would say it has succeeded to a terrible degree. And it's not to say communism didn't just do that. A lot of it, too, is looking at one of the systems of subversion will look at trends that are already moving within a society and just helping along those negative trends. If drugs are a problem in the society, then no, they'll get to the drug trade.
If China is involved, drug warfare, that's a big old part of it.
Exactly. You know, if they're having trouble with, let's say, people making counterfeit goods, they'll get in the counterfeit good market. Simple as that. If there are negative cultural trends that are damaging, let's say, the religious foundation of the society, that's like, the moral backbone of social order, you know, regardless of what religion or what country it's in, they'll subvert it, right? They'll create their own movements and or their own associations that preach a new version of it, or get their own people to rise up within its ranks and then use it to destroy it from within, to promote, you know, degenerate things and things. Yeah, this is what they did with, for example, liberation theology, with this whole idea that it was a new version of, you know, they found that after Che Guevara was killed, they found they couldn't subvert Latin America as easily as they thought they could. That people were more devoted to religion than they were to any idea of, you know, work and, you know, career, you know, kings or whatever. And so they had to use the religious systems to create communism. And that was liberation theology. I mean, long history to this. I won't get into the whole thing, but this is just an example of it. But Matt, you had asked about the idea of, you know, kind of right and left, and that a lot of times we understand communism only as the kind of opposite of fascism. That actually came from the Frankfurt School. That was the whole, what was it called? Totalitarian, I can't remember the word they used for it. Basically, after World War II ended, after the crimes of the Nazis were exposed, all the socialists kind of knew that, oh man, this is going to expose us too, because it's like the same dang thing. It's national socialism or international socialism. And even then, the lines aren't that thick. Because a lot of communist countries, Chinese Communist Party, North Korea, whatever, they flip-flop between nationalism and internationalism, depending on whatever they need at any given moment. This is why some communists say, "Oh, North Korea is not communist; they're Nazis, they're national socialists," because they promote nationalism. Mm. You know.
So you're saying that the idea that the communists and the Nazis are totally different was actually an idea that was created by communists to distance themselves from the thing that was being criticized by the world.
I would say the idea that it wasn't socialism was done like that. Hitler, I think, would have criticized communism too in its final synthesis, right? He wasn't looking to lose power. A lot of those guys weren't looking to lose power. The idea of communism is that you would have to lose power eventually, right?
Okay. Well, I mean, in Hitler's Nazi Germany, individuals who were Aryan had, you know, still had, you know, private industry. They controlled most of the means of their own production, you know, and so on, right? There was still that level of freedom for Aryans.
It goes through stages. One of the ideas was that you would be assigned to your workplace, right? The state would – I mean, this is one of the later ideas. More like fascism. But, you know, the idea was that you'd be assigned to, you know, your workplace. That everything was owned by the government, and through taxation – the government kind of owns the corporate structures. Corporate fascism and things like that, that the corporate systems themselves could be subverted through their structures to create these kind of collectivist systems. And through taxation, through regulation, the government can maintain control of them. I mean, this stuff's complicated. And I think it's where a lot of people go off when they try to say, oh, well, what about capitalism? What about this, right? It's actually you know, these things have found their way into a lot of systems, including the corporate structures and including in the United States under, you know, FDR and stuff. And, LBJ and the corporate reforms and things like that. You know, we have it here, too, to a pretty terrible extent. You know, you have public companies, right, publicly traded companies, and there's no legal restrictions. You know, personal accountability within the corporate structure. You register something as part of a corporation, and that thing's used in something terrible, then, you know, you just dissolve the assets of the corporation it's under and so on. I mean, I won't get into this whole thing. But the idea of right and left is misunderstood, and I think that was what it was framed on. They framed the idea of communism and fascism as being just opposite ends of the same system. But what's that based on? What is the basis of that? Is that based on the idea that you understand fascism as being, I don't know, I mean, you just understand it as fascism itself and communism as being communism, and that's just the spectrum of government, that these totalitarian systems that both use identity politics and, struggle, and these things are somehow, you can only operate within the boundaries of these two very similar systems.
Well, in the U.S., right, mm-hmm. like people on the far right criticize people on the left as being a bunch of commies, and people on the far left accuse people on the far right of being a bunch of fascists.
They criticize it within the boundaries of the actual fascists, which are very few, I'd say. And the actual communists, who are in fact pushing for socialism, which there are quite a few, unfortunately. But when you get into like a lot of conservatives have nothing to do with fascism. For example, it's libertarian, most of them, which is actually more like classical liberalism, ironically. You know what I mean?
Because they're arguing for less
government control. In the U.S., a lot of people on the left, they understand this right-left dynamic is only within the boundaries of fascism or communism. That's the sole spectrum they understand it on, and the systems really aren't that different. When you get
so you're saying that the political spectrum, as understood a lot of times even in this country, is essentially a false paradigm.
Well, you can't say it's false. It's a paradigm. I would say it's not a paradigm that encompasses all of society as they try to make it all encompass all of society. It's a paradigm, whether false or not. People can, you can say right and left, and you just have a different concept of what that means. If conservatives say right and left, they believe it's a power structure, that on the far left is absolute control of the government, totalitarianism, and on the far right is like anarchy. But even when trying to understand communism, you can't understand it like that. You can't understand it as just a system of political power either. Because if you go back to the earlier forms of communism, even the anarchists were part of it. The idea, if you get into like William Godwin, for example, right? He talked about radical atheist anarchist. He talked about using atheism, right? Or sorry, anarchy. He said the practice of personal anarchy to achieve intentional communism. The idea was you could bypass the stage of socialism by looking within yourself and destroying your recognition of hierarchy, of morality, of tradition, of belief, and these things. And by eradicating all of these morals and values and things like that the socialist structure would try to eradicate, you can achieve what he called intentional communism. That was the whole, anarchist movement, right? And so even within the conservative view of right and left, you can't use it to understand communism. Same thing with the left, the liberal view. You can't use it. I mean, I wouldn't even call them liberals, because technically libertarians these days are more liberal. You can't use it to understand communism because both are communist. If you want to get into the French Revolution viewpoint of it, it was more like a right-hand path, left-hand path. When, you get into the older systems of it, and that's more like a religious concept of whether you believe in traditional values or oppose traditional values, for example.
Well, Josh, I had a understanding of what right and left meant, and you have now flipped, inverted, and destroyed that notion. I think you might be a communist.
I used to be more of like an anarchist. I used to study all this stuff, and so I know this. I mean, to empathize with people, I used to believe in this stuff probably more than most people out there.
So why do you think communism still holds a fascination today?
I think, honestly, a lot of people don't know what it is. Its talking points sound, it tries to make itself sound like it represents compassion. It tries to make itself sound like it represents caring for others, that it calls for equality, and it calls for these things. It tries to say it's the answer to hate, it's the answer to, all the problems in the world, right? But what does it do to achieve that, right? I mean, this is what people don't understand. So, I have friends who are like former anarchists, and they're total socialists now, and I don't know what to tell them. Because, how can – this is something that Frederick Bastiat noted actually in his book, The Law, is that socialism is inseparable from mechanisms of exerting power, right? So you can talk about the idea that you want, to seize the wealth of the 1%, right, whatever you want to call it, whether, you know, under Hitler was the Jews, right? They were like the 1%. You can say you want to seize this wealth that has been, you know, according to them, gotten through illegitimate means, that these people have, you know, taken advantage of another part of society. Fine, you can say you believe in seizing it. But how do you seize it, right? What is the process of seizing it? And what if they refuse to give it? Then what do you do to them? What happens then? We've seen what happens. We've seen it over and over. What happens is that you need to create mechanisms of enforcement which will either seize it by force, throw them in prison, or kill them. Over and over and over again, we've seen this.
Okay, right? So let's...
I mean, that's just one example, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's take something that's kind of coming up in contemporary society, the idea of universal basic income. Now, that's a popular kind of socialist idea.
Yeah, I mean, candidates who identify as democratic socialists have offered this idea that everyone should get a universal basic income.
I'd say it's the political ideology of living in your mom's basement. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, I'm being taken care of, and that person works hard, and they have plenty of money to take care of me, and I, you know, they should just have to take care of me, you know, regardless of how I try to get by in the world. What is then the incentive of the person working to work hard to support you? Why not just say, oh, well, I don't want to have to work every day, and, you know, like, you know, why would I hate my job? Why would I have, you know, not me, of course, but some people, you know, they hate their jobs. Why would they want to work if half their money or even more of it, if it encompasses that, is going to go to a guy that says, oh, I don't feel like working. I'm going to sit at home and play video games all day.
What do you mean? It's just the government gives people money.
Well, but I mean, it, you know, typically the argument from people who support universal basic income is that it doesn't mean people don't work. It just means they have some basic like safety net. So like is this – I mean, this is socialist, I think, like by definition.
It's like beginning stage socialism. The idea, though, is that people eventually just stop bothering. It's one issue that Denmark has, for example. They have free college, for example. You can go to college, but you have people who, you know, stay in college for the rest of their lives. You know, they take a class here and there and just live off the government for the rest of their lives because they can.
But that's not a large percentage of Denmark.
It's a large enough percentage to make people question whether it's a system they should keep or not. They're weighing whether they should keep it or not because of that. And also, you know, that... You know, what benefit does it bring, right? I'd say that the ability for a life to sustain itself, the ability for a person to work hard and make their way in the world, there's a satisfaction with that. When you start breaking the lines of, you know, the culture of hard work, the culture of the belief that you should be self-reliant, the culture that says, I should do things that are uncomfortable, that I need to do this, whether I like to or not, because it is the right thing to do. Right? To be self-reliant is a satisfaction in itself. And I should take responsibility not just for myself, but even try to benefit others. Right? This is a traditional concept. Communism, I think, destroys this. And I think this universal basic income idea, it sounds lofty, but what does that mean? And then what does it mean, too, when more people start getting in on it? What does that mean, too, when, say, the only powers left are the big corporations and, you know, the impoverished masses who don't work at all.
Wait, how do you get to there from universal basic income?
Well, I'd say because you're talking about a safety net, and so you it's safety net so you can sustain yourself whether you work or not, regardless. One of the arguments, you know, against that is one. Well, what's the purpose of why would I bother working? Why would I work a minimum wage job if my income is only, you know, I barely get by as it is? Why would I work a full-time job and still barely get by? This is even now a lot of arguments with like the welfare system that you can, you know, for a long time you could get by on it, right?
Well, so I think that is the argument that people make for universal basic income, that like instead of funding welfare programs, people would be given like $1,000, which really isn't enough to live on, but instead of taking welfare, they're given money that then they need to decide for themselves what to do with.
Yeah, I mean, we'd see where that would go. I would argue that it wouldn't last. I would argue it wouldn't last. And if you look at countries that have done it, they're already talking about getting rid of it. you know.
I mean, my concern with universal basic income is that it actually pushes wages down, because people will be willing to work for lower wages. And so obviously a minimum wage can solve that in the short term, but that also creates another set of issues. But like over the long term, as inflation continues, it'll keep wages low, because instead of having to earn, you know, you'd be willing to work for $6 an hour instead of $10 an hour, because you also have this, you know, this safety net. So ultimately, then corporations kind of can take advantage of this, and they pay workers less and less over time, and then you can't really undo that system. Yeah. And then the other issue, I think, is that the government then has an enormous permanent burden to have high taxation in order to support the distribution of this income. So it actually becomes a major burden on the government. Of course, it gives the government power as well. Yeah, well, that issue is not the same as the, you know, communist issue that you've been talking about, right? Or is
it? Well, you know, like I said, you can't look at the surface issue to understand this. I mean, the surface issue would be, you know, well, give people free money, right? So you steal money from hardworking people, right? And then you give it to people who don't work or might not want to work.
Well, you're assuming that taxation is theft.
How is it not theft? It is. I would say not all taxation is theft, but how is plunder? How is it not plunder?
I mean, obviously, if you're taking like the great majority of people's income, it's theft. If you're taking only
50%.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think you can. There's arguments for that, but there may be some level of income taxation that you couldn't really call theft. You call it a necessary taxation to support. Like, we can't support everything through tariffs anymore.
Well, it's only because the size of government has gotten massively, massively higher than what it was originally intended, mainly to support systems that they create for programs like this.
I mean, isn't the military like one of the biggest chunks of the budget?
Military is pretty big, and I think it's because the U.S. has, I think, unwittingly become kind of the one taking care of the whole world. That after World War II, you know, you had pretty much just the Soviet Union and the United States as the two main military powers. Europe didn't have the budget to do it, and so they kind of just got used to that system. And so the U.S. had to kind of fend off the whole communist system and fight all these wars, and some countries chipped in a little bit. But for the most part, I think that, you know, Europe and all these other countries that benefited from this, they just don't think they need to play their part anymore. And I think Trump has actually kind of gone after them a bit for that, you know, with like the United Nations and NATO and stuff.
Yeah, that is accurate.
Yeah. But, and it's true, too. I mean, yeah, it's it does take a big part of the budget. But the idea is that how big does government actually need to be? What role should government actually play in our lives? But I'd say even, you know, to what extent should they play in our lives? But I would say even this is, you know, you can't really understand communism with this. I would say that back to the idea of basic income, the communist goal wouldn't be just to, let's say, you know, take money from the wealthy and give it to people who, you know, might not feel like working as much. The goal would be to destroy the culture of hard work. The goal would be to destroy the culture of self-reliance. The goal would be to destroy ideas like generosity, right? That you should give, you know, you should enjoy helping others, that you should find joy in, you know, helping others. If you see someone,
what about the joy of being taxed at a 70% rate?
You know, I mean, but yeah, there you go.
But I can see what you're saying. So it's more like a cultural subversion, but on the economic level, what it ends up doing is it gives the government actually a lot of power over people's lives, because when the government is taxing things at a high rate, it's controlling a large amount of your income.
And then what happens is you start having people saying, I can't find work, right? Because people no longer believe that you should try to start your own business if you can't find work. You should no longer be self-reliant. They expect people to create work for them. They want the government to create jobs. They don't want to go, you know, start something themselves. And because they create more and more red tape, it becomes more and more difficult to do that. If we look at Denmark, right, the Nordic model, it's very easy to start your own business. It's one of the reasons why they're able to have that kind of system, right?
And don't they describe themselves as capitalist.
They do, but for some reason socialists here call them socialists. Mm. But yeah, because they do have free health care, and they do have the free college system, and arguably a lot of people are moving towards paid health care plans anyways, because the government one's pretty terrible. It's just like with the U.S. You know, we have, of course, free health care for veterans and stuff, but the system is horrible. The waiting lines and stuff are horrible. Anyone who can afford it's still going to get, you know, a private health care company. But, you know, the idea with this, like I said, is to destroy these values, right? And also, and then you're going to have people inevitably saying, well, $1,000 a month isn't enough to live on. I can't find work. What are you going to do about it? And they're going to say, oh, well, we should increase this, right? Look how much these people make. Look how much these big corporations and business owners make. We need to take more of their money and give it to them. Eventually, you increasingly turn society against each other. The people who do work hard say, I'm already supporting you. I'm already paying money out of my pocket so you can get by.
And kind of what you see happening now is where the ultra-rich are able to figure out loopholes to avoid all of this, and the burden falls on the middle class.
It's a huge issue. And then, ironically, the ultra-rich are usually the ones who push this. And why do they push it? They push it because it eliminates competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because if you're eliminating small business, then those disruptors, they never spring up, basically.
Exactly. You never have to worry about who are then the competitors if there's no such thing as a middle class. Hmm. You have a massive upper class and a massive lower class. So communism or socialism has achieved in its later stages in every instance.
I mean, it sounds like a conspiracy, but it just makes economic sense. Eliminate your competition.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they do. And it's ironic that you have all these big guys talking about tax us more, tax us more.
So hypothetically, if I were a giant super rich corporation, which I'm not, I would want to encourage a super high minimum wage, knowing that I can just automate things, but no smaller business can start up with that as a base cost.
Yeah, or even encourage, one of the big arguments now is with, Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook is talking about coming out and adopting these new forms of internet censorship. Well, what does it mean then if every person who runs a website needs to be in charge of a form of censorship and you are responsible for that censorship? Does that mean, what does that mean when you have to, you can't have money to develop an algorithm to search and censor. You don't have the money to, monitor everything that's posted online. You don't have this. All the mid-level competition is going to just die, pretty much.
So by creating regulation that is effectively internet censorship and making any internet provider or internet or any website responsible for that, only the super rich companies can afford those kinds of compliance.
It's very much like the way it's run in China, where what the Chinese Communist Party does is they tell, Sina, Weibo, or other sites that you are responsible for policing the content on your own site. And if they don't do that, then that website, the people who run the website get in trouble, or individual users get in trouble. And so it's like that's the actual system now in China that they're using for censorship.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting point you bring up, Matt, because, people look at China, which is a very extreme society under the Communist Party. And it's hard to imagine the steps a society would need to take to get to that extreme. And, it seems impossible that the United States could ever end up like China.
Yeah. Well, part of the idea, just on the note of regulations for this, the Chinese Communist Party uses this as warfare. So if you look at the whole unrestricted warfare doctrine, they list regulation warfare as part of it. The use of regulations is a weapon. You know what I mean?
Mm.
You could even say tariffs are kind of like that, but regulations even more so. So the CCP can create laws that require a company to hand over their intellectual property if you go to China. Suddenly China, if you do business there, they can use your technology and mass produce it and create a company to compete against you with your own product.
You have to team up with a Chinese company.
Yeah, stuff like that. They can do this. Or, you create restrictions on foreign companies and really light restrictions on domestic companies, for example. That's a form of regulation warfare. When you deal with even like one of the issues we have right now in the U.S. is that, for example, a lot of these environmental regulations are putting farmers out of business. You know, all the farmers are going out of business. And under the Environmental Protection Agency, if it rained and you had a puddle, that puddle would be government property. It would be regulated, you know? Right. I mean, this is how insane things had gotten. And so, you know, pretty much, yeah, what happens then? These regulations put all these small companies, all these, you know, independent, more independent types out of business. What's left in the end? It's these massive factory farms. It's, you know, massive, massive businesses that can withstand high taxation, that can withstand all these regulations. And everyone can't withstand it. But again, this is part of the progression of communism.
Right. And if you're a big business, you can also hire lobbyists to write the laws, because a huge number of laws are actually written in the United States are written by lobbyists, not by lawmakers, especially on the state level.
Yeah, that's true. And think tanks.
Yeah. And so, like, we think of our elected officials as writing the laws, and they do sometimes, but a lot of times they'll just accept or barely change a pre-submitted regulatory document that could be from a corporation.
Yeah, no, it's totally accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So wait, is communism everywhere?
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah, I mean.
Right here on China Unscripted.
Yeah.
We own the means of production. We also have essentially no economy or money.
There you go. That keeps it easy.
Won't someone please sponsor us?
Some giant corporation trying to use regulation to crush competitors. Will you please sponsor us? Did we?
We didn't even get into unrestricted warfare or ideological subversion.
No, I think we'll probably have to have you on again. Like,
yeah, if your listeners will let me on again. I hope it didn't offend too many people. But honestly, like, this stuff is terrible. The surface talking points do not represent the reality of things in practice, and I think this is where people go wrong with it. I think most of these people are good people. I mean, I used to believe in a lot of this stuff until you really realize what it entails.
Because it's talking about making the world a better place, ending injustice and inequality.
Yeah. And it also relies on a misunderstanding of what the world used to be, the values that were lost. There's a whole kind of rebranding of history. One of the systems they use for this is critical theory. That was a Frankfurt School concept.
And I think that's going to have to be for the next podcast.
But I mean, also Marx has sort of framed history as the history of the world as a history of class struggle,
which was what critical theory did.
Okay. Yeah. So
people have a false understanding of what the world was without communism. Right. They can't understand things outside the lens of communism.
So if you say that the world was horrible in the past and now we're making it better, then you're like, okay, I'm willing to accept a system that's better than the thing I've been told happened before.
Yeah, and they talk about this whole that the crimes of communism are necessary costs to achieve its goals, right?
I mean, trashing the past is a big part of what the Chinese Communist Party did in China, at least.
Like, they were really good at trashing the past, yeah.
Yeah. So it destroys the past to force people to believe in the communist future, getting that fifth stage of...
I've heard it described before as a war against memory. The people who live under these systems, there's a constant war against memory that they don't want you to remember what life was before.
That reminds me of some animes I've seen. Well, Josh, do I want to say thank you for joining us?
I'm feeling terrible right now. but also weirdly enlightened.
Thank you again for joining us, Josh. That was all a little. I think my head might have exploded.
It was very intense.
I definitely want to know what the listeners have to say about this, because a lot of this was kind of new information for me. Certainly, I'd never heard the arguments about. You know, today we covered everything from Illuminism and the occult and Satanism all the way up to corporatism in the United States today. And Bernie Sanders got mentioned. So
if you're listening to this on our YouTube channel, leave your comments below. But I would say, you know, usually 95% of our listeners never leave comments. But in this case, I would encourage you to leave your comments to specifically talk about what you think, what you learned, and if you'd like to have Josh on again and what you'd like him to talk about. And even if you're one of those, you know, 95% of people who basically never leave comments, it would be great if you could leave a comment this time because we'd really like to hear from you.
Yeah. So, Josh, yeah, thanks again for joining us. Maybe we'll get you on next time to actually finish talking about Unrestricted Warfare.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. And thank you for listening to China Unscripted. I hope you made it all the way through. I mean, I found this fascinating. But, yeah, Shelley will be back next week. So, once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
And we'll talk to you next time.